You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Two studies in this week's JAMA confirm what many people probably suspected. Screen fewer men for prostate cancer and its incidence will drop. But a question remains, what can be missed? An editorial in JAMA put it into perspective nicely, and we've got that editorialist on the line with us. Dr. David Penson has kindly agreed to be our guest this week. He is from the Department of Urologic Surgery at Vanderbilt Medical Center and is professor of urologic surgery and medicine there. Welcome, Dr. Penson.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
You wrote about two studies in JAMA. The first found a declining incidence of prostate cancer after the USPSTF discouraged PSA-based screening in older men in 2008, and then again after the 2012 recommendation against it in all men. Also in that issue, a second study confirmed the drop in the screening rate, but only among men younger than 75. Were those results unexpected?
Not to me, no. I think that anyone who takes care of prostate cancer patients on a day-to-day basis has seen in the last two or three years a drop in newly diagnosed prostate cancer cases, and it just seems like it's a direct result of a drop in screening rates. So I was not at all surprised to see these findings.
And your editorial offers a nice summary of recent findings, other than these JAMA findings that are still fueling the argument over screening versus non-screening. Could you briefly describe those?
Sure. And you know, as by way of background, you know, this has been a contentious debate now for probably 20 years, almost since the PSA test was introduced, with one side being very adamant that everyone should be screened starting at age 40 or age 50 annually, and the other side being equally determined in the fact that no one should be screened. And it's all really now boiled down to two studies primarily. One is an American study, the PLCO study, which randomized men to screening versus no screening, and a lot of men, 78,000 men, and followed them for about 10 years and showed no difference. Now, the problem with that study, if you are a screening proponent, and I think it is a valid criticism, is that there was tremendous contamination of the control arm. So the guys who were in the quote-unquote no screening group, most of them got screened. About two-thirds to three-fourths of those men had at least one PSA test. So, you know, it wasn't really a trial of screening versus no screening, but there's no two ways about the fact that this trial was negative.
Yeah.
The other trial that people point to is the European study, the ERSPC study, the European Randomized Screening Study for Prostate Cancer. And what they found there was a benefit to screening in the aggregate, but perhaps not as great a benefit as one would have liked to have seen. And that's the argument that perhaps this we don't need to be screening everybody all the time. Depending on your viewpoint, you can use these studies to end up at a very pro-screening viewpoint or a very anti-screening viewpoint. And, of course, it's always, we have evidence, but it's interpreted differently by different people.
Yeah. Well, you observe in the editorial that in the light of this continuing controversy, patients and their physicians are, quote, caught in the middle. Is there a way out?
It's a very difficult problem. I do think there's a way out. And the first thing is that people really have to, the people being the vocal either opponents or proponents of screening, have to sort of become a little bit more open-minded in their approach to the problem. They really have to accept that there's validity to both sides of the argument. For the average physician and patient, for the time being, the best thing you can do is have a very honest discussion with one another and accept the fact that there are pros and cons to each approach, and each man has to make a personal decision with regard to what he should do, accepting that, like I said, there are pros and cons to each approach. In the long run, the way out is additional research, and unfortunately, it's not going to be in the form of a large randomized clinical trial because they take too long to do. And at this point, it's going to be very hard to have clean intervention arms or clean control arms. So we're going to need to use our existing data and do very smart simulation studies and smart observational studies to think about, you know, what is the best way, if there's a way at all, to screen men? Who's at highest risk? What sort of, you know, annual strategies every other year we should use to best optimize this test? It's going to take us a few years to get this right, and so I think patients and their docs are not going to have an easy way out for the time being. But I think in the long run, if we stop clinging to our emotional arguments that we've been having for 20 years and agree that we need to fix this problem, we'll get there. And the other thing I'm hopeful for is new technologies, new biomarkers may almost make the discussion moot as we get better genomics and other ways of diagnosing and potentially treating prostate cancer.
So with the pendulum of advice swung far away from PSA-based testing, you note that there are likely to be upswings in the cancer incidence that may not be apparent for years. So apparently clinicians are going to have to accept a trade-off between overdiagnosis and the inevitable misdiagnosis. I was reading the estimates in your editorial and in the paper that there were about 33,000 fewer cases diagnosed in 2012. And to get my mind around that number, I realize it's about the capacity of Boston's and the Red Sox Fenway Park, about 33,000 people. That's a lot of people. But of those people who were not diagnosed with it, who would otherwise have been with PSA screening, the estimate is that about 1 in 27 would die of prostate cancer. Is that right?
That's right. And that may or may not be a conservative estimate if you look at other studies, modeling studies of the same data, because that's 1 in 27 at about 10 years of study length only for patients in the age range of the study. Uh-huh. If you, you know, carry it out for the entire population for a lifetime, that number tends to drop. Uh-huh. But in the end, there's no denying the old adage is true. More men die with prostate cancer than of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely a human cost to not screening. And that was the purpose in the editorial of pointing out that we know that if we stop screening, we will avoid the side effects of treatment, we will avoid the side effects of a false positive screen test, and that's good. We want to avoid those. But by the same token, as you said, there are going to be misdiagnoses, so men are going to be presenting with more advanced disease, which causes more morbidity, and there's a human cost in terms of mortality, whether that's roughly 1,200 of those 33,000 men or 6 or 7,000 of those 3,300 men, depends on what estimates you use and what you believe, but some men are going to lose an opportunity to be cured if they don't get screened. The question is, are we willing to accept that?
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm seeing, and the data certainly back me up, and I think that this is, you know, reassuring to me both as a urologist but also as someone who's interested in public health, is that we're becoming much more aware of the problem of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And so men who are getting a biopsy and are being found to have low-risk prostate cancer, the ones who are most likely to have overtreatment or most likely to be in the overtreatment category if they are treated, urologists are much more often now using a strategy called active surveillance, where they don't immediately do surgery, they don't immediately radiate, and instead what they do is they closely follow the patient and only go to the more aggressive intervention if the patient shows evidence of progression vis-a-vis their Gleason score, their pathologic grade goes up, or if their PSA goes up exponentially. And the strategy is working, and it works well. Now, again, there are side effects even to that strategy because you have repeat biopsies, repeat PSAs, but still it's better than the actual side effects of the surgery. And that may be a good way to split the difference while we figure out if there's a better way to screen these men.
Okay. And So you said earlier that the best path forward in the meanwhile is an open and honest discussion with patients. Would that be your final advice for clinicians listening in?
Well, certainly, in 2015, that is my final advice, because there's no right answer here, and we just don't know. And one of the things I hear talking to my colleagues in primary care is that, wow, it takes a long time to talk about screening, and it's really nuanced. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
And for a lot of guys, it comes down to a quick discussion with their primary care doc, where the primary care doc says, look, we can test it, and you can decide whether or not you want to follow up on it. And I think that's an important piece to remind docs and patients, is that you don't have to go all the way down the rabbit hole. So if you get a PSA, the patient may say, it's a little elevated, I don't want to do anything right now, let's check it again next year. Or they may get a biopsy, and they may go to the urologist, and the urologist may say, you should have a biopsy. And if they get the biopsy, the patient can say, look, it's a low-grade cancer, I want to go on active surveillance, or I don't want to do anything. So there's always, this train does not have to go all the way down the track.
Okay.
Patients and their docs can always pull the plug on the process. So that's one thing that I always tell patients, I tell primary care providers when they're asking me about this, is that, you can always stop. It's hard to do, but it's only hard to do because we haven't laid it out to patients. The other point that I would make is that there are a lot of online resources available to help with the patient education piece for the screening discussion in 2015. And they're good resources from unbiased sources. The CDC has a great resource. NIH has information. It's not simply, the two opposite sides of the screen argument putting out propaganda to push forward their agenda. Frankly, it's very well-known, well-respected organizations that are trying to make patients make smart decisions and help doctors deliver the best quality care.
Well, that's great advice, Dr. Penson. Thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was our 191st edition. The others are all at podcasts.jwatch.org. Thanks to Kristen Kelly, my executive producer, and to you for listening. For the NEJM Group, I'm Joe Elia.